Welcome. I'm Michael Hawley. It's nice to see you all. Have a seat. I'm just going to stand and out of politeness. This is about the agony and the ecstasy, ostensibly. But before we get into those things, I want to be sure not only to thank you all for coming, but to thank the Plymouth Rock Assurance Company, which had a strong helping hand in making this slice of the book festival happen. I was thinking about the title, The Agony and the Ecstasy. Does it ring bells for some of you, the Michelangelo fans in the audience? In my own creative life, it's mostly agony. I'm still waiting for the ecstasy part. But I thought back to Irving Stone's novel and to that movie. It's one of my earliest recollections of seeing kind of a grown-up film on television when I was a kid. We had just gotten a color TV. I was about 6 years old, 7 years old. And I was at home sick with the flu, and I turned on the TV, and it was the movie of the week. And there was Rex Harrison as the Pope and Charlton Heston as Michelangelo. And my one takeaway from the whole movie was that they both seemed like real jerks. But somehow, those jerks got together and gave us the Sistine Chapel. Now, I've no idea how true that to life that movie really was, but it captivated me. I don't know why. It sort of hooked me at an early age. And like a lot of you, I assume, I've always been fascinated by the creative itch and what it is in the mix of talent, maybe genius, circumstance, lucky breaks, happy accidents that causes people to be able to produce these things that we come to cherish. And what I want to do is hand it over right away to our three authors. Before I do, though, I need to remind you all, their books are available, as you've seen in the back, but they're available, too, to write sweet sentiments in the book. It's a great opportunity, and I think there's something very special about that. In fact, I'm going to mention one small little anecdote. When I was a professor at MIT, I had a business trip that took me to Sri Lanka. And I only knew one person in Sri Lanka, and that was a science fiction writer, Arthur C. Clarke. I called Arthur. He invited me over. I sat in his library, which was filled with books. And Arthur, at the time, was confined to a wheelchair, post-polio syndrome. And after chatting for 5 or 10 minutes, he excused himself. He had to go use the loo. And he said, just make yourself at home. And I did. How can you not be at home in a library? I went to a shelf. It was filled with science fiction novels, not surprisingly, and I pulled a book off the shelf. It was an Isaac Asimov book, and I opened it up, and there was a beautiful little note from Isaac to Arthur. It said, Dear Arthur, thank you so much for the chats we had before writing this book about robots. I think you'll notice one of your ideas on page 47. Love, Isaac. So I put it back, and I pulled off another book by Bradbury, and that also had a sweet note thanking Arthur for this and that, and every one of the books, Crichton, you know, they all were love letters from one writer to the next. And I was sort of overwhelmed. Suddenly it was like the whole library was glowing. So I can't encourage you enough. Get a book, get three, and impose on one or all of the authors to write something nice for you. So with that, I'd like to hand it over to Miles Unger, who's written the book about Michelangelo, to kick us off. And each one of them, so you know, has 10 to 12 minutes to talk a little bit, and then we'll have some chit-chat and questions from you.
Thank you. I have to make sure I can actually operate the remote control here. Thank you all for coming. It's great to see all these faces here. I have to say that when I first heard I was going to be on a panel on creativity, I said, that's good. That's something I can actually sink my teeth into, because one of the themes that sort of runs through my book, Michelangelo, A Life in Six Masterpieces, is the kind of odd notion that Michelangelo and his contemporaries really invented the notion of creativity. Oh, there we are. Today we tend to think of creativity as the one essential attribute of the artist. Everything else can be discarded without sacrificing a claim to belong to that exalted profession. Skill, choice of medium, in fact, the obligation to actually make anything at all. Without creativity, however, the artist simply vanishes. But for centuries, creativity was not even part of the job description, much less a defining principle. For most of human history, creativity, insofar as the concept was even available, was actually seen as antithetical to art's proper function. Creativity is closely linked to originality. It is a form of self-expression, or, to put it another way, an expression of self. To be an artist, we insist, mere skill is not enough. The true artist must bring something unique to the work, a vision not shared by anyone else, a vision unimagined, indeed unimaginable, before the artist plucked it from whatever mysterious storage bin beneath the skull contains the most profound and unexpected products of the human imagination. We owe this idea to the Renaissance, an age in which, in the words of art historian Hans Belting, quote, "the aura of the sacred was replaced by the new aura of the masterpiece." No one did more to give birth to this conceptual revolution than Michelangelo, who, along with his devoted followers, bequeathed to us the cult of originality and the legend of the tormented genius. And this is a work of Michelangelo's from about the 1520s, one of his many unfinished work called The Captive. This is not a Michelangelo, in case any of you were wondering. In contrast to modern notions of creativity, which demand at the very least the expression of one man or one woman's subjective experience, the aura of the sacred demands anonymity. To the extent that an icon or votive statue makes one aware of the artist as an individual, it loses its magic. The Madonna of Impruneta, seen here, is merely one of thousands of similar miracle-working images revered in churches across Europe. And I chose this particular one, not for its aesthetic merit, but because it was actually one familiar to Michelangelo himself, since it was carried in solemn procession during times of plague and political crisis. Its function was not to give aesthetic pleasure, but to mediate between the heavenly and earthly realms. And like most such icons, its origins were shrouded in mystery. It was painted in a local workshop, probably sometime around the middle of the 13th century, but that prosaic history was deliberately expunged in favor of a more inspirational backstory. According to legend, the panel was actually painted by St. Luke himself, from life, his hand in turn guided by an angel. As is the case with all such magical images, the individuality of the craftsman who actually made it was suppressed so that it might more easily accommodate the supernatural. In order to play its magical role, the icon had to deny the artist's unique vision, his quirks of eye and hand, his subjective interpretation. A work I hope is familiar to most of you here. That's Michelangelo's St. Peter's Pietà from about 1498. In the St. Peter's Pietà, carved when Michelangelo was only 23, we discover a completely different conception of what constitutes a work of art and of the artist's creative role. Not only does the artist display an attention-grabbing mastery of the medium, but he claims creative ownership of the work in more overt ways. His interpretation is deliberately idiosyncratic, subjective, wholly original. It shatters formula rather than repeat it, so that you never forget it was made by a particular man with a particular set of gifts and in a particular way of approaching the subject. Even the contract Michelangelo signed for the Pietà reveals the competitive, individualistic ethos of the Renaissance, obliging him to make, quote, "the most beautiful marble that there is in Rome today, and that no other living artist, master, excuse me, will do better." The most obvious expression of this new attitude is the cheeky bit of graffiti Michelangelo sneaks into the sculpture. His signature, you can see it faintly over there, carved with studied carelessness along the strap that runs across the Virgin's chest. It reads, "Michelangelus Buonarrotis Florent Faciebat," in other words, in Latin, Michelangelo Buonarroti, the Florentine, was making. While he treats the signature as an afterthought, clumsily carved so that the letters are either crowded together or hidden beneath the folds of the Virgin's robe, it is actually carefully plotted, replete with learned allusions and displaying a deliberately false modesty that would have appealed to Michelangelo's more scholarly admirers. The peculiar form of the verb facere, to make, derives actually from the ancient author Pliny, who wrote in his preface to his Natural History, quote, "I should like to be accepted on the lines of those founders of painting and sculpture who used to inscribe their finished works, even the masterpieces, with a provisional title such as Fasciebat Apelles or Polyclitus, as though the art was always a thing in process and not completed, so that when faced by the vagaries of criticism, the artist might have left himself a line of retreat to indulgence, by implying that he intended, if not interrupted, to correct any defect noted. Thus, through an apparently casual gesture, Michelangelo stakes his claim to be the true heir of the great masters of the past." In truth, even Michelangelo's most ardent supporters were concerned that by signing such a work in such a brazen fashion, he could be construed as exhibiting hubris, even sacrilege. To deflect the charge, his friend and first biographer, Giorgio Vasari, invented a rather improbable tale. Quote, "Such were Michelangelo's love and zeal together in this work that he left his name, a thing that he never did again in any other work, written across a girdle that encircles the bosom of Our Lady. And the reason was that one day Michelangelo, entering the place where it was set up, found there a great number of strangers from Lombardy who were praising it highly, and one of them asked one of the others who had done it. And he answered, 'Our Gobbo from Milan.' Michelangelo stood silent, but thought it something strange that his labors should be attributed to another. And one night, he shut himself in there and, having brought a little light and his chisels, carved his name upon it." Even in Vasari's implausible story, we can sense the artist's ego asserting itself. Anonymity has given way to authorship, timeless conformity to a prototype replaced by a bold assertion of originality. This was the revolution engendered by Michelangelo and his colleagues, one in which the personality of the artist, his genius, his originality, in short, his creativity, was the only thing that really mattered. Michelangelo's contemporaries acknowledged the magnitude of his achievement. In his epic poem, Orlando Furioso, Ariosto inserts a tribute to the artist, punning on his name by calling him Michael, more than mortal man, angel divine. If the aura of the sacred survived the Renaissance and endures to this day, it was transferred from the artwork, the sacred icon, to the artist, whose mastery of the ineffable stuff of the imagination allows him or her to approach the status of a god. Thank you.
Thanks, Miles. It's a pleasure to introduce Jan Swafford, who's written the large tome about Beethoven. I don't know if any other biographer is going to step up to attempt another one anytime soon. I don't know if Jan is going to say any words about Beethoven, but hopefully we'll circle around to that topic a little bit later if he doesn't. Jan.
Am I on? On? Okay, hello. I'm pushing this a little bit in the talk. I've written it out. So I'll apologize in advance for talking kind of fast.
Michael.
But I'm going to try to get it all in. I like the title of this panel, Agony and Ecstasy, because it's kind of vague. It's not clear whether it has to do with the biographer or the biography. So what I'd like to do is a little unusual, but I hope it'll be interesting, and say something about the process of putting biography together. What I propose to talk to you about is a biography I never intend to write. Some background. Mostly we write biographies about famous or important or unusual people because they're the ones the public is most likely to be interested in and the ones for which we get the best advances. My own opinion, having written of biographies of people like Beethoven and Brahms, is that actually, if it's done well, a biography of anybody at all would be just as interesting as one about somebody famous or important. It's in that context that I want to talk about the biography I'll never write, which is of my Uncle Larry, my mother's brother. A couple of things about my beliefs concerning biography. I think most people look at biography as a kind of literary interpretation of someone's life. That's not how I look at it. Given that we never really understand anybody else, and given that we don't often understand ourselves all that well, It seems to me unrealistic and even morally suspect to interpret somebody's life for money at a distance when they're not around to defend themselves. I think a biographer has to respect the ultimate mystery of any human being, the ultimate mystery of a person's life. To me, a biography is a narrative of a life more than an interpretation of it. The bits of interpretation I do indulge in are just things that in the course of my work seem to me to become obvious. In the same way, I don't consider biography to be some kind of literary structure. I don't think a person's life has that kind of structure, so I don't try to cram the details of the life into one. Life is not like a book, and I want my biographies to be more like life and less like a book. And if they're discursive, that's because life is. The structure of my book is the structure of my subject's life. What's important to me is what's important to my subject. I also think that each book should, in its form, its style, its tone, be wedded to the person it's talking about. My biography of Charles Ives, I hope, has some of his wildness and eccentricity. When I got to Brahms, he was a different kind of guy who spent most of his life simply writing and performing music and fighting with his friends. He only had a bit of significant drama in his life in his early 20s, when in close succession he was proclaimed to the world as the savior of German music by Robert Schumann, after which Schumann went crazy, after which Brahms fell in love with Schumann's wife, his pregnant wife, and so forth and so on. It was a big, fat mess. After that, it was clear to me that Brahms wanted no more drama in his life, and by and large he didn't have any. So that biography was quite straightforward. When I got to Beethoven, I was concerned with the craftsmanship in his music because that craftsmanship was so profound and influential on the music that followed him. So in these terms, let me lay out some of my never-to-be-written biography of Uncle Larry, something about its interest, I think, and its structure. For starters, in this one, I could be more intimate and a bit more interpretive, I think, for the reason that I knew the guy, his family, he lived on my street. He was what's usually called an ordinary man. Except that when you truly know someone, I'm not sure anybody is ordinary. Larry and my mother Lucille were born to a lower middle class family in the town of Riceville, Tennessee, population somewhere around 400. This was red dirt, deep south, working class town featuring fervent religion. I remember people at revivals hanging onto the tent posts and screaming. Decades-long feuds, casual and sometimes brutal racism with dusty cars and crank phones and my grandmother's daily eavesdropping on the party line. The family's dynamic with the children was this. My mother was unquestionably my grandfather's favorite. He was her little girl. Larry was the cut-up, the one who got in trouble, the one who started smoking at 10. None of that amounted to anything wildly rebellious. Grandmother was the ultimate mom, making costumes for the children's theatrical productions on the front porch and things like that. One story about Larry would be featured in the book. It says a lot about him and Grampy, my grandfather. Larry and Grampy used to take baths together. One day, I think it's a joke, Grampy decreed that they'd begin their bath with a bucket of cold well water poured over. Larry gamely stuck it out in the bathtub when Grampy poured the water over him. When it was Grampy's turn, after the first few drops Larry poured, Grampy vaulted out of the tub and took off running through the naked through the house, Larry chasing him with the bucket. When Grampy reached the front door, his hand on the knob, Larry caught up with him and gave him the whole bucket. They laughed about it for the rest of their lives. What marked Larry's childhood was that he was wonderfully and kind of strangely handsome. He looked unlike anybody else in the family. As a biographer, it's a belief of mine that how you look can have a considerable influence on your life. Brahms, in his youth, was this little, wiry, blonde, extremely good-looking guy. And I think that had something to do with how and who were impressed by him at first sight. Beethoven was ugly and chronically ill, and that had much to do with his life and his inability to find a wife. They asked one of the women later that he was courting why she didn't respond, and she said, because he was ugly and half crazy. In high school, Larry starred on the football team, and he was the school heartthrob. My mother said that he got around half a dozen calls a night from girls. But Larry's handsomeness was odd. He had deep black curly hair, a kind of olive complexion, big lips. In my book, his singular handsomeness would begin an arc of story that has to do with the South, with the 1950s, and with race. The other thing about Larry was that he was a natural tinkerer. He was one of those people that had an instinctive understanding and curiosity about how things worked. I mean, like a number of kids, he'd take the family radio apart, but he actually would put it back together and it still worked. That gift created a career as an engineer, with jobs verging on big time, but not quite. Grampy was determined that his children would go to college, very unusual in that town. In college, Larry became the head cheerleader. He fell in love with Doris, the homecoming queen. In old photos from the tennis court, they were a spectacular-looking couple. After college and the Army, Larry married her. He'd spent the war working on airplanes in the Pacific. One day, he told me, the Enola Gay landed at his field. Rumor was that it was carrying something big, but they didn't know what it was until they heard about Hiroshima. Larry and Doris came back to Chattanooga, and he got the first of a string of pretty good jobs. They lived what was on the surface the 1950s American dream of prosperity and respectability. Everybody who knew, we knew in the 50s, wanted to be normal. They had two girls who got pretty dresses and lots of stuff. I remember Larry every Christmas playing with the kids' toys with just absolute delight. I remember Larry is always brash, busy, putting up a putting green in his yard, tinkering in his workshop, shirtless in summer and proud of his physique. One day he showed me a part he had machined and compared it to the same part by somebody else. He was holding these two things, and how his showed more skill and pride and attention to detail, and he wanted me to know about those things. He laughed a lot. He played golf. He presided at the grill. He made no secret of his prejudices. When I told him I'd gotten new roommates in college, his first words were, "Are they white?" "One of them isn't," I said. He looked grim. "I'm very disappointed in you," he said. "Don't tell your Uncle John." I have to skip around now, but my point is that this was all a huge deception. And that deception says something to me about the sense of placidity and respectability that dominated the 50s, how superficial and hypocritical it so often was. In a word, through all this respectable, smiling, family sitting together in church every Sunday life, there was a secret that I suspect was not spoken of because we didn't do that. We were WASPs until it became unavoidable. Larry was seriously alcoholic. His daughters told me later that neither of them could remember anything in their lives before high school. They had blanked it all out because of Daddy. He drank vodka so it wouldn't show on his breath. He had bottles stashed all over the house and in his workshop. Finally, it all hit the fan. Larry crashed the car in the driveway and fractured his skull. In the hospital, my mother watched him going through DTs. She told me it was the worst night of her life. To make a long, sad story short, Larry got on the wagon, fell off, and finally managed to stay sober. In his last years, the big smile, the joie de vivre, the brashness and confidence were all gone. His wife and my cousins became fanatically religious. My mother told me, "I feel so sorry for Larry stuck in that house with those women praying all the time." And then he died, lung cancer from all the smoking. And then in my book, and in my sense of Larry, comes the climax. One day my brother and I were visiting his widow and our cousins when Terry said to me, "Did you know that when both Jeannie and I were born, Daddy was terrified that we'd come out black?" My brother and I were just stunned. Doris, his widow, had just come in, and I blurted, "Is this true?" She shrugged, "Yeah, isn't that funny?" And she walked out. I'll have to leave it there with all the questions that raises. Did Larry know something about grandmother the rest of us don't? Had he been teased about his looks in childhood? What does this all add up to in the relentlessly respectable, conformist, profoundly racist world of the South in the 1950s? And I remember something my brother said to me once. He said the whole family were so teeth-grittingly determined to be respectable, and we really turned out a pack of loonies. Which leads to my final point. A person is made by his or her time, and so a biography is not only a portrait of a person, but of a time, a place, an era, an ethos, all of them working for well and ill on everybody there. I think Larry's story of an ordinary person could make a nice book, but likely nobody would read it. And in any case, I promise I'm never going to write it. Thank you.
That's like a huge bonus. If you don't have a question about Beethoven for Jen, you can certainly ask more about Larry. I want to make a kind of bridge by way of introduction to Sarah Lewis, because Larry's talk made me think about the nature of biography as a kind of profession, what it means to look into the patterns of lives or to use a life as a window into a time and place. A couple of years ago, when Steve Jobs was alive, he called me. Steve was my closest personal friend. We lived together when we were starting Next. And it was late in his life, and he called because he had agreed to allow a biography to be written. How many of you have read the Steve Jobs biographies? Only a couple. Well, I'm not going to say I can save you trouble, but it's an interesting book about a remarkable guy. My question to Steve was, why? You know, why are you doing that? You've never wanted that. And his answer was simple, because he had a big life but hadn't had time to kind of organize those memories and wanted his kids to know a little bit more than they might otherwise. And I said, who'd you get to write it? And he said, Walter Isaacson. I said, well, congratulations. Walter has written my favorite book about my favorite historical character, the Benjamin Franklin biography. It's my favorite book about Franklin, with the possible exception of Franklin's own autobiography. Terrific book. And I like the Einstein biography, and so terrific. You know, he's a good man for the job. The next call came, and it was from Walter. And I said, Walter, why are you writing this book? And he said, well, why wouldn't I? You know, he's on the same level as these other guys, as Franklin and Einstein. This is Steve Jobs. And I said, okay, tell me what you want to do. And he said, well, I'm going to write this big sort of story. I mean, it's a huge life, lots of pieces. And I said, why do you want to do that? I said, you know, you're going to spend days, weeks, months sitting down with Steve, having conversations, and really understanding Steve in a way that nobody else has tried to do before. Why don't you take those conversations and turn them into a book? Because lots of other people can write a biography, fill it with pages, cover the arc of the life, use it as a way to sort of explore Silicon Valley at large, but you are going to be in the catbird seat. You'll have the conversation that no biographer will ever be able to have. Why don't you make that the book? And he said, well, that sounds interesting. Why don't you just tell me some stories and we'll see if we can get them into the book. And I said, okay, fine, I'll tell you stories as long as you don't put me in the book. So we had an agreement. The book came out. It was a big book that kind of put Steve on a podium. But it didn't provide the sort of specialness of the window that Walter had. And the reason I'm telling you that long story is because of Sarah's book, Rise. Sarah looked at hundreds of lives and sat down with dozens and dozens of creative stars and really had that kind of privileged perspective. It's a fascinating book that looks at the patterns of these sorts of people. She's shifted from Yale to Harvard. As a Yalie and as an MIT professor, I'm kind of not allowed to say what a wonderful move that is, but she's a Harvey now, she's a Du Bois fellow, and she's working on a new book that perhaps she'll tell you a little bit about. Sarah Lewis.
Thank you very much. All right. Great. Oh, I'm so short, I think that I'll actually stand here. Good evening. It's so good to be here. We got a little call and response there. Good evening.
Good evening.
I love it. We really are in a congregation. Someone once said to me, you know, architecture is the one form of art you can never escape. I'm sort of feeling that in this room. Jan's comments made me sort of rethink my talk, so what I'm going to do is tell you what I was going to tell you, and then tell you what I now like to, and make sure we have time for questions. I wrote a book that came out in March called The Rise, Creativity, The Gift of Failure, and The Search for Mastery, in large part because of my experience as a curator at the Tate Modern and then Museum of Modern Art, and as a critic at Yale School of Art, I started to notice aspects of the story of creativity and innovation that I didn't feel were being taught or discussed in the life stories of different individuals like Steve Jobs often enough. I thought about this from really a very young stage of my life when I was 17 and I applied to college. I applied early to Harvard with this essay about what I was coming to understand was central to the life of anyone creative, and that is the ability to find a gift from failure. I wrote about my own failure. I wanted to be a painter. I'd entered this competition when I was in high school as a sophomore, and I had won what was really significant for a high school student, and that is a computer, you know, $5,000. This is a big deal in the early 90s. And I was thrilled, and I was actually shocked to have won, so shocked that my attire conveys how ill-prepared I was to be standing in this stadium on this podium winning this gold medal for the Olympiads that the NAACP has. It's called AXO. It's this competition. Rosa Parks was there giving out these awards at Cornell West, and I love the photo. Don't like the fact that I had this little tennis skirt on because I was really trying to just meet some boys. I was, you know, a teenager. The next year, I entered the same competition and won nothing. And I was at that point because I really wanted to be an artist and had experienced my first very public failure, pretty devastated. I learned a great deal about my own tenacity, my own fortitude, and decided to write about this and closeted the essay from everyone in my life, my parents, my college advisor, and only revealed it a day before the application was due so that I could essentially force their hand and have them permit me to send it, and I did. I started to write The Rise and came back to Harvard to investigate what had then been created, and that is the Harvard Success Failure Project, looking at very much what the book is about. Harvard professors and others really examining in a public but yet safe space the irreplaceable advantages they've gained from this experience in their lives. And I heard Dean Fitzsimmons, the longstanding dean of Harvard College Admission, speaking about being expelled from high school. He was expelled and then had to reapply to a high school in the neighboring town and spoke about resilience and grit, similar things to what I had described in my essay. And I was so stunned, I went up to him afterwards, and before saying anything, he looked at my name tag and he said, "I remember your essay." And it was only in that moment that I realized I had, for 18 years, essentially been writing this book. I had been considering the life stories of different individuals and noticed some key traits that I'll tell you about briefly, sort of speed talking here. I learned that Duke Ellington, for example, said about his work, "I merely take the energy it takes to pout and I write some blues." You know. I learned that famously, Thomas Edison told his assistant, incredulous at the inventor's repeated attempts to invent the incandescent light bulb, "I have not failed. I've just found 10,000 ways that won't work." You know. I learned that Paul Taylor, the MacArthur-winning choreographer and dancer, had his early work that crystallized his now iconic style so panned for its minimalism in 1957 that the reviewer left it completely blank. Blank. It was empty newsprint, save Lewis Horst's initials at the bottom and the name of the dance company at the top. Bill T. Jones told me about this. "It was a scandal," he said. "For dance receives so little coverage in print as it is." Paul Taylor, thinking back on this moment, said, "And yeah, it wasn't even a very big blank." Very tiny. There's so many of these stories. I learned that the 1930s RKO screen test that said, "Can't sing, can't act, balding, can dance a little," was in reference to Fred Astaire. You know. I learned that Martin Luther King received C's not once but twice in oratory class in a seminary education, which he received mainly A's and B's and went on to lead this nation with the power of his spoken truth. There are so many of these stories. J.K. Rowling spoke about it during her Harvard commencement speech. She spoke about rock bottom being the solid foundation on which she built her rise. And Oprah Winfrey did as well. So it made me think that we need to reconsider the true nature of creative human endeavor and the true nature of iconic work. After finishing The Rise, which is entirely about this topic, I looked back and realized I had not written a kind of self-help book, but there were traits that did run throughout this atlas of stories of over 150 individuals, entrepreneurs and artists, athletes and inventors, and I'll tell you briefly what they are. The first is that these individuals, if they were able to have an iconic rise after difficult start and on an improbable foundation, focused more on mastery than success. They were focused far more on what was not simply an event, having accomplished something great, but the near win, what they didn't quite like about that experience, such that it gave them a propulsion to keep on going. In a sense, if success is an event, mastery is a journey, and they were focused on that. Think of it this way: how many times have we looked at a masterpiece? We've seen several in this presentation, an iconic work, and deemed it such, not knowing that its creator considered it hopelessly unfinished or riddled with difficulties and flaws. More times than we possibly could know. Paul Cézanne is one example. He didn't sign 90% of his paintings because he didn't feel that they met his goal to realize nature in paint. William Faulkner published The Sound and the Fury. It goes on to its success, but he's not happy with it and republishes one of the novel's later editions with an appendix with a rewritten section of the book. He had attempted this rewriting 5 different times. It really can all be best summarized by Michelangelo in a quote that is essentially a prayer. He said, and I love this so much, "Lord, grant that I desire more than I can accomplish." You know, and this is the journey, but it means focusing on near wins. The near wins we see very vividly in athletic competition, the frustration we see on the face of the silver medalists, just in comparison to the glee on the part of the bronze medalist, you know, who's just happy they didn't get fourth place and not medal at all. That's very much the position of these masters. This, it is to say that, you know, mastery has inbuilt a sense of the incomplete. It's sort of Albert Einstein showing you his study on the last day of his life in 1955, sort of summarized the journey also in a letter to a 6-year-old girl who wrote to him. She was worried that she was a little bit below average in math. True master focused on the near win. He said to her, "Do not worry about your difficulties in math. I can assure you that mine are still greater," he said, you know. Second trait I focus on, and through just being able to look at these different stories of how Nobel Prize-winning inventions took place, different creative endeavors, is that to sustain mastery, people need to give themselves a private domain in which they can give up their expertise to see problems anew. You can call it maybe being a deliberate amateur. If I had more time, I'd tell you about the Nobel Prize-winning work that Andrei Geim and Konstantin Novoselov did precisely this way. They won the Nobel Prize in 2010 for the discovery of the first ever two-dimensional object on the Earth. It's revolutionizing the electronics industry and nanotechnology. And they found it using scotch tape and a pencil. All graphene is, this two-dimensional object, is a one-atom layer sheet of carbon, which is hanging out in an ordinary pencil. But experts didn't dare just use that rudimentary tactic until they created this tactic of having Friday night experiments in their laboratory, times where they permit themselves to ask very childlike questions. When they submitted their findings from this almost childlike study to the preeminent journal Nature, it was rejected, which is, I think, after looking at this atlas of stories, an unintended compliment to any innovator when you're being rejected. So the deliberate amateur is something I saw again and again in the lives of individuals, but often in the tactics of organizations that need to remain innovative. The final trait, and it's a difficult one to summarize quickly, is really grit. but not having so much of it that it becomes dysfunctional persistence. It means knowing when to change course in order to truly meet your goal. Angela Duckworth's work at the University of Pennsylvania has really pioneered the study of this. She just won a MacArthur for this work on the importance of grit, the ability to pursue your goal over years, if not decades. I went to her because I was curious about the life of an artist that I am probably the only one in this room knows of as an artist. He's really known as the inventor of the telegraph, speaking about Samuel Morse, who spent 26 years prior to that invention as a painter, the first professor of painting at NYU. His ambition for himself was to be a Michelangelo, a Titian, a Rembrandt, and when he couldn't support his family, deep in debt, depressed, he decided to take the stretcher bars of one of his failed paintings and turn it into the model of the telegraph that sits in the Oval Office today. When President Obama pointed to the model of the telegraph to Michael Lewis, being interviewed for Vanity Fair, he said to him, "This is the start of the internet right here." And it is. Morse is our first tech entrepreneur. But what he might not have known is that the grit that he summoned, his letters show, was developed through the process of being creative in the arts. Art is really the one time in your life as a young person where your goal for yourself and your tactics to get there are the only information you need for your objective. You know, it's different from learning any other subject. No one can tell you that you're wrong in how you're creating something if you're, say, trying to render through a drawing what this architecture looks like. And Morse described the agency that he developed so that he would know when he was really on the hunt of his goal and when he was off course in letters to colleagues and friends when they were, as Thomas Edison's assistant was, incredulous over his attempts over 20 years to secure a patent from Congress, which was almost as intractable then as maybe it is now. So this, for me, was a question I had for Angela. How does grit remain supple and nimble? And she pointed me back to the very thing that I do, focus on the arts. But the final thing I'll say is that this is also deeply important, not simply because we all would love to know the mechanism by which people create something new, but because of how lost we would be without the force of the arts on us. During the Civil War, at another church in Boston, Tremont Temple, Frederick Douglass, of all people, stood in 1861 and tried to get people to understand what he called the power of pictures to create thought pictures in us. His argument was that it was not going to be violence or any other form of combat that would get us to see ourselves anew, but something as seemingly small as a picture. It's an old idea. Aristotle would think of this when he said, "Reason alone is not enough to make men good," meditating on the power of the arts. You know, over time, when you look at, and I'll sort of end with this, some of our most impactful changes, they have come from the force of the arts. Jan's talk made me think of this final anecdote, and it is of a man who, in 1931, you know, in Texas, decided he was going to go to a dance just to, as I did in a way at that competition, he was going to go meet some girls. I was trying to meet some boys back then. Instead, he found himself just struck still by the power of this trumpeter whose music and notes and lyricism let him know that he was listening to genius. This young man was Charles Black, a white man, and he was a boy at the time and was there with his friend. And his friend, too, recognized that genius, but shook his head and uttered an epithet about African-Americans at the time and walked away. But Charles Black was sure he was looking at genius, and he was listening to Louis Armstrong. He knew in that moment that segregation must be wrong, because if there was genius coming out of this horn, then the whole institution must be incorrect. So he started walking towards justice, by which he meant the Brown versus Board of Education case, in which he was one of the lawyers. At Columbia and Yale, where he was a constitutional lawyer, he would hold annually an Armstrong listening night to remind his students, his colleagues, and himself about the power of the arts to excavate us out of some of our most intractable failures. That's really why I wrote this book, to remind us of that. And I'd like to end there. Thank you very much.
Okay, I'm going to allow myself one question, and then we'll turn it over to all of you. One of the things that struck me was that I'd never thought about Beethoven and Michelangelo in the same breath before. And the more I started thinking about it, the more I realized there were some strikingly common notes in their lives. And we heard hints of some of them. Ego, right? Arrogance. These were characters who thought they were better than the other guys, and they had to succeed in the cutthroat world that they were in. One that wasn't talked about, the ability to land a commission. You know, you have to be able to support yourself somehow. And even if you're sociopathic and borderline crazy, you still have to be able to keep the patrons knocking at the door somehow. One that didn't come up, which I want to ask about, sounds a little silly, but it's hygiene. Okay, there's a vivid story of some fellow going to visit Beethoven, and he walks in and he sees this horrific scene. There's mildew on the ceiling, garbage on the floor, dust on the piano. He looks inside the piano. It's like a Brillo pad. All the strings are busted. Of course, Beethoven couldn't hear. But the sort of kicker was underneath the piano was Beethoven's chamber pot, and it was full. Michelangelo, I'm not sure if this story is true or not, but I remember when I was a kid, my mother telling me, in a sort of motivational way, that Michelangelo never took his socks off. And there came a time when somebody took pity on him and had to use like a putty knife to scrape the socks and the fungus off his feet. Couldn't have felt very nice. But, you know, you think about hygiene. And by the way, having had a long career at MIT, I've seen some patterns like this as well. I'm not going to name names. It's sort of a signal that the person is a little more obsessed with other stuff, with trying to get the work done. Discuss amongst yourselves.
Well, the story is true about Michelangelo. It was boots, not socks. They had to, he took his, somebody removed his boots and, you know, a year's worth of skin came off with it. Yes, it was, yes, I think for Michelangelo and probably for Beethoven as well and many other artists, the work was so all-consuming. He really had no time for family, for friends, and I think there is something, I'm not a psychologist, so I don't know what, you know, how common this is, and whether, it's probably, you can probably find your neat genius. I don't know how Steve Jobs was the roommate, but
he was clean.
He was clean, okay, there, so it's not a universal attribute of genius, but
he had incredible chops. I remember, I'm using a musical term. I'm talking about Michelangelo, seeing the work he did when he was 18 in the cathedral in Siena was boggling, and by the time of the Pietà, it's just stupendous. And he must have been told. But the thing about Beethoven was he was told at age 10 that he was the next Mozart, and he never doubted it. He was terrifically self-critical, but I think they both had an obsession with mastery, and that's where what Sarah said came in. Michelangelo wanted to be the best carver who ever lived, and Beethoven had a trouble with certain aspects of musical mastery. He had trouble with counterpoint, but he was obsessed by it, and he also had what people called his raptus. He would just go off, and he had this when he was 10 years old. People would be talking to him, and he was just gone. And I think that's one of the ways that he did it, that he survived the enormous physical and mental suffering that he went through. I think when he was composing, he was in his raptus, and nothing could reach him.
Sounds a little Asperger-ish. Of the 150 that you looked at, Sarah, do a certain percentage exhibit these sorts of traits, the obsessiveness that causes them to leave other details by the wayside?
Absolutely. There are a couple of things that are coming to mind, though. I think what you're describing is what I at least call in the book a surrender, you know. Mm. And it's not giving up in the martial context sense. It's, you know, giving over to the calling that the work has put on your life and which results in this behavior or outward manifestation of surrender, essentially. But to open the launch of the book, I did a talk with Bob Redford and Dave Eggers, a few others, at Sundance. And there too, this idea of being kind of lost in the clouds constantly came up, you know. So those, neither one is in the book, actually, but those two come up in more ways than I could describe.
Let's see if we have a question or two from the audience. There's a microphone in the back. Why don't you go and grab it? And while you're getting over there, I love the way you put these sort of things that we think of as problems in a slightly more positive and constructive light. It reminds me of when I was a kid, Yale, I played a piano recital, I completely lost my place. And there's nothing worse than having a total mental blank in front of your parents, everybody. And after the concert was over, my teacher took me aside and said, well, you know, Michael, just remember, your best rehearsal is your last performance. Question.
It's about observation. Do you think creative artists observe differently, or what they observe is different?
I'm not sure where the how to separate observation from creation. I think that somebody was sitting around my local cafe, and somebody I know vaguely came up and said, asked me what I was doing. I said I was writing a book on Michelangelo, and she said, I love his work because he's so realistic. And I'm thinking, well, he's really not that realistic. That what makes Michelangelo such a genius is not simply that he reproduces, but that he transforms what he sees into something else. And so I guess I'm not sure to what extent it's, I mean, he's obviously had enormous powers of observation, but he somehow also transformed it. Where I think that his genius probably consists more in sort of the transformation part rather than the seeing. But I'm not really sure where one leaves off and the other begins.
I do think artists sometimes just simply look at the world in a way that nobody has. Charles Ives was a kind of a prodigy as an organist, but he used to listen to church congregations singing, and he was listening to what they actually sounded like. He wasn't listening to the tune they were singing. Some of the people were above it, some of the people were below it, and what was actually happening was this moving tone cluster. And he was the first person to ever notice that, and since he was a creative person, he made use of that. Or 1,000 people singing a hymn at an outdoor meeting, he listened in a completely new way to something he was quite familiar. And the same way I think of Einstein, who's a lot of his ideas about relativity came from riding on a streetcar and saying, if I were riding on a beam of light, what would it look like out there? Very simple.
Yeah, no, I think, go ahead.
Maybe time for one last question.
First, it's so nice to see so many Yaleys in Boston. and second, I guess the question, maybe Sarah, is will we allow failure now? It seems that, especially with public officials, if they make a mistake, it's off with their heads. And are we ever going to have the opportunity to have, you know, really talented people, you know, learn from their mistakes and recover? Because it seems like if you made one mistake, you know, you're out of the game.
No, I think it's a critical question. Michael, I did just want to say regarding observation, absolutely. I think that what artists reveal to us is how we all could see, right, if we focused a bit differently. And I think that's what's so important about looking at their biographies. The importance of failure, I think it's critical for pedagogy, for parenting. I wrote The Rise at first as a children's book, in large part because I wanted to make sure that my children and the next generations could understand this idea, which we all do instinctively. I'm amazed by how many times if I speak for a general audience, a large audience, the first question will be from someone in high school or young in college. I think there are different ways and techniques people have done this. I think in school settings, making sure that there are safe havens to take risks that might constitute failures are very important. I think looking at the lives of these individuals more closely, icons who we celebrate for their success, such that we don't sanitize out these moments of failures, are ways to start to normalize the process. And it will take, I think because of our focus on perfectionism and increasingly the condensation of stories that's happening because of sort of social media, you know, it's going to take time, I think, for people to remember what Martin Luther King went through. I didn't even tell you that he developed a stutter later in his life that Harry Belafonte talks about, you know, that only went away when King made peace with the fact of death, right? He gave up his ultimate fear, you know. it's powerful when you really start to excavate these moments that have been excised from the record of different individuals. And once we do that effectively, I think we'll better understand the true nature of mastery, really.
It's hard to grow up in the spotlight, though, and modern media is such a huge spotlight. Mm-hmm. You know, I think of some of the great jazz performers who grew up playing on steamboats like Louis Armstrong, and, mm-hmm. and in little clubs, and you had a chance mm-hmm. to fall on your face and learn and make mistakes, and you don't. Mm-hmm. If you're famous at 18 or 20 or 22 now, you there's no mm-hmm. place to make mistakes, and I think it does a lot of harm. It's tough.
Very true.
Yeah, that gives me a chance to try to offer a closing note. Your mention of jazz reminds me of my favorite keyboard player of all time, hands down, Art Tatum. To my way of thinking, nobody has ever played the piano better. And this was a man who was blind, a blind jazz pianist, and people like Rachmaninoff, Gershwin, they'd go and their jaws would drop when they heard Tatum play. He built a whole world by himself almost, and was able to do that in a way because he had the luxury. He wasn't too handsome. He wasn't swept up in a multimedia spotlight. He wasn't siphoning off half of his waking moments into Facebook. He could do one thing and one thing only, and he did what he loved, and that was play the piano, and nobody ever played it better.
And he practiced scales hours a day.
Everything. You've been wonderful. Everybody should rush to the back, grab books, but let's take a moment and thank Miles and Jan and Sarah. Thank you all. Start signing.